From the first night that we met and he took me home and fucked me, you have wanted me gone. Well, Mikey, you finally got your wish. There's nothing standing in your way anymore. He's all yours.
Still queer as folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We are back for season 3 of the Still Queer as Folk podcast. If you enjoy our show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to us and leave a 5-star rating.
You can also find us across all social media platforms at Still Queer AF.
And once again, Matt, what does AF stand for?
As fuck.
We have a thing now. Hashtag as fuck.
As fuck.
This episode is called Mad Dog Kenny. It's the season premiere of season 3.
It first aired in the U.S. on March 2nd, 2003.
It was directed by Jeremy Podeswa, who directed 4 episodes of the show, and this is his 3rd. Podeswa is a heavyweight director, having done episodes of 6 Feet Under, The Tudors, American Horror Story, Boardwalk Empire, Game of Thrones, and Matt's favorite, The Handmaid's Tale. He's probably the most accomplished director in queer as folk land.
I mean, he's literally hit them all. The story and teleplay for Mad Dog Kenny was by Cohen and Lippman, the executive producers of the show. And like season 2, they take story credit for all of season 3. There are a couple of new additions to the writer's room this season, though, so the teleplays may be a little unexpected here and there.
Here's a recap of Mad Dog Kenny from Queer as Folk, the book.
When Justin walks out on Brian at the rage release party, he thinks that he's walked out on all of his friends. But Michael is the only one glad Justin is out of their lives entirely.
While one relationship has ended, others are beginning, moving forward, and celebrating milestones.
Ted and Emmett have intimacy issues, but move past the emotional obstacles for a night of uninhibited sex.
Ben moves in with Michael after subletting his apartment for his canceled trip to Tibet.
And Lindsay and Melanie celebrate 8 years of mostly monogamous love.
I've got some problems with this synopsis because it's not quite accurate.
That's true.
So, I mean, like a lot of the writing in this book, it's a little...
Yeah, because what we described it as it's a little fanboyish.
Yeah, it's a fan book.
Nothing wrong with that. Just it can tilt in certain ways.
Well, that like the first line, Justin walks out on Brian at the Ridge release party. He thinks that he's walked out on all his friends. He didn't think that until Michael said that
and acted like a real. You know what? To call him a cunt is not fair to cunts. But we'll get to that.
Okay, so let's dig into the A story here. And there really was only an A story. There was no B story. So this episode almost entirely revolves around Justin, Ethan, Brian, and Michael.
It's like Bob and Ted and Carol and Alice. That's what this is.
It's a nice atypical intro from Jeremy Podeswa. There was an interesting throwback to the episodes that started out with Michael narrating them. You remember back to season 1? Mm-hmm. I used to complain about those early on. And as the season went further and further, I started to like them a lot more. So it's nice to have Michael do this cute little narration.
Well, that whole rewind technique, recall back to, I believe it was the Briss episode from season 1. I really did not like that sports commentator.
Oh yeah, that was the same thing.
Yes, it was.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, like that's my mind went immediately to that episode where because we have this action and then it's literally him saying like, "Well, let's see what led to this," and we literally rewind
the tape
to like what it took us all the way back to the rage release party and picked up from there. So where we left off in season 2. They managed to set us back so that we are immediately picked up for season 3.
Yeah, I thought that was a little curious, though, because it was the same, but with better hair. Everybody had better haircuts.
Yes.
And this was literally only 1 week later.
Yes, everyone made it to the stylist in that week, which is great.
And they grew out hair, got extensions, everything. So this is a season of messy layered haircuts for all the men.
Well, that's because in those early 2000s, that was definitely the style. I knew I went from being that kid that hated doing my hair in the morning, so I always made sure to get buzz cuts, to wanting to live that, I don't want to say
Justin Timberlake look.
Though that all like all alt boy kind of look emo, where it was shaggy hair and you just kind of let it grow to whatever.
Oh, we need to put a picture of that up.
Nope. There is no evidence of this. It has all been destroyed by order of the governor of Missouri. So
this episode was just a continuation of the season two finale. They might as well have like shot them at the same time. You know, maybe they did. Maybe we should inspect the hair here to see if the Babylon scene,
if it
they had the
just,
old hair.
Because you know what? Then that would be major points for continuity to keep that going.
Yeah, they got that rage set completely accurate over the two seasons. Something I didn't like was Michael announces that Brian and Justin just broke up.
I have to find Brian.
Okay.
Last time I saw him, he was feeling no pain.
Yeah, getting it on with Shirtless Wonder 4,689.
He and Justin just broke up.
What? What are you talking about?
Everyone was there last episode and saw that. And now everybody's like, what happened? Brian and Justin just broke up. We know. We all watched.
Everyone saw. Michael makes a point to say that it was different. He makes a point saying that Justin just left with someone else, and they're all like,
yeah, so?
And?
We do that all the time.
Yeah, like, Melanie literally says that. It's like, don't they always do that? And Michael is, of course, saying, no, this time it's different. And then now he gets to be the real pissy little self that he's always wanted to be against Justin.
There was an interesting green screen scene when they came out of Babylon where we see Pittsburgh, though not really. We
Pittsburgh,
see this, yeah, we see the skyline down the alley, and there's like this busy boulevard that's nowhere near the size of the quaint Rue de Liberté. I liked it, though. It was like a little extra budget was spent on this exterior shot. Normally, it looks very interior.
Very soundstagey.
Yeah. This one had a nice green screen with cars going up and down. It almost looked almost like the Champs-Élysées.
Well, and remember, you know, this episode aired in 2003, so we've already dealt with two Lord of the Rings movies with amazing CGI. So I'm sure some of that magic ended up in this episode.
I didn't know there were such big hills in Pittsburgh.
There probably aren't.
So Justin woke up next to the naked violin player serenading him. I think we just offended half our audience by going, whoa.
Right. So, like, I understand that our dear listeners are very clearly not in that Ethan camp, but
I am.
Oh, OMFG. He was playing the violin naked.
Yeah.
My basement flooded.
What?
Have you never heard that before?
No.
Soaked. I was soaked.
We soaked the sheets. I'm almost now positive that hipster that woke me up playing that Smashing Pumpkins song stole Ethan's move. I think he must have seen that. It was just like too identical.
Go back to your date book in 2003 and find out if this happened the day after the episode aired.
You know, I bet I could, because at the time I was a very rabid blogger. And so I just like wrote everything
down.
Poured it out. Live journal. Record. I was there.
Yes.
So I still have it. It's set to private. Don't go looking for it. But I could probably go back and see if the timing ends up. So this is apparently the first time that Justin stayed over, and Ethan is ready with breakfast, which was a chocolate and a rose. He just had this.
I'm into it.
He just keeps that in the house. It's in the pantry. Let me go over to the pantry and get a piece of chocolate, one rose.
A fresh rose. Off.
Yeah. Maybe he has a garden. Justin has to leave to go to class and work. What fucking night was this?
Tuesday? I mean, I
can't. Wasn't this supposed to be the night of the rage release party?
Yes, but it seems they go to Babylon every night, so I really don't know where the timeline adds up. That
well, which is okay, day of but the week. Justin has to go to class on Sunday.
Is it a Sunday? Wait.
You'd think the rage release party would be either Friday or Saturday.
I don't know, because they go to Babylon so often, like it's just sort of part of their daily routine.
Yeah, I just wanted to know what class he has I can see him working at the diner.
But. Sure. Yeah. You know, Sunday brunch.
I've always liked Justin's certainty with Ethan.
Well, I also have to pick up my stuff.
What if he's there?
What if he is? I don't care. I'm with you now.
There's no ambiguity. There's no wondering if his partner was all in. There's no wondering if Ethan will stay the night the way that Justin was always running off. Justin is just very certain about Ethan. I'm with you now. I love that.
I wonder if that's a young person in a relationship move.
It's a twink move?
Well, not just a twink move. I'm talking about a person of Justin's age where there are very clear distinctions that I now have a boyfriend, whereas I feel as we get older, there's this like, oh, yeah, I'm hanging out with this person. Oh, yeah, I'm kind of dating this person. Oh, I'm dating this person. Oh, then we're exclusive. Oh, we're kind of monogamous. Like, we have all these levels.
We're just waiting for Christmas to see if we buy each other gifts.
Exactly.
Get sentimental.
I think for Justin, here he has so much more steady ground than he ever had with Brian, that at least we've seen in the past two seasons. That for him, yes, absolutely, 100%, it is certain. I am with you now. And yeah, this is why he is so grounded.
That line comes back in a couple of variations, both in this episode and the next one. So I do like that there's that conscious thought put into what you were just talking about. Michael in the comic store the next day. I really had to suspend disbelief about this whole runaway success of Rage.
After one issue?
Yeah, one issue, one party the next day. There's just like too much campy dialogue from the patrons.
When is the next issue coming out? Are they going to get together?
What about JT? What about like, Zephyr? Wait a
minute. You would have thought that this comic book had been going on for years.
Right.
And that these rabid fans are being destroyed in the fact that it's not continuing. They're like Annie Wilkes from Misery.
I'm your number one fan.
I love that movie. In fact, I don't even watch it anymore because, as you know, like I get kind of bad nightmares from horror. And
you can't think about someone hobbling you?
No, not at all.
Thwack.
Oh. Didn't you have a piece of trivia about Annie Wilkes that you told me? Like something about the hobbling? Like she was...
Yes. Yeah, so if I remember correctly, there was a version of the hobbling. So for our fans who don't know this moment in Misery, there's a scene where Annie Wilkes takes... our author's legs and puts a block in between the feet and takes a sledgehammer and breaks his feet in such a way that they bend so he remains incapacitated. And I think there, if I remember correctly, there was a version of it where she actually cut off his feet.
Ah, that's what I was thinking.
Yes, that's what it was.
What was that guy's name? James?
James Caan.
Yes. No, that's out of the way.
We can continue.
I felt like that scene in the comic store was really only to tee up the entire episode to Justin and Michael fighting. It just seemed that the writers needed to add a little bit of gravity towards their fight so that they would be actually giving up something by not making up.
Yeah, so let's get into this whole Michael sticking his nose in the business that is not his, but of course he's going to fucking do it because he's Michael.
Well, it's Michael from season one. It's Michael 1.0. I felt like we had Michael 2.0. Yeah.
This is Michael 1.0 turned to 11. Because he was a terrible person. Not annoying in the way that like he continues to pine for Brian, but malicious.
Well, that's the interesting thing about him pining for Brian is he moves on. He dates other people. He moves across the country. He comes back, but he's still pining for Brian, even though he's dating the professor.
I assume, in love with him.
Yeah. It just starts, the Brian-Michael dynamic just starts to ring hollow. Like, as you say, let's move on already.
Move the fuck on.
Yeah.
I feel like I have to say this every time something bad happens with Brian and how it relates to Justin, because then Michael has to jump in some way and he uses this defense like, well, he's my best friend, so I have to do this or that or the other.
Yeah, I'm just tired of that storyline.
Like we've dealt with it for two seasons.
Yeah, you can be best friends and still not have to like fix get up them. In his business. Yeah. It reminds me of that Coldplay song, I Can Fix You.
Ugh. Sorry, continue.
You don't like Coldplay?
No.
What?
That's, we'll save that for another podcast about my hatred for Coldplay.
Oh my goodness. What about the Smashing Pumpkins when there's a naked hipster at the foot of your bed playing it on acoustic guitar?
Oh, I'm into the Smashing Pumpkins.
That works?
With or, okay. with or without the hipster.
So there's some great flashbacks when Justin showed up at Brian's loft to collect his stuff.
I was very into this montage.
This was just a buffet of my favorite scenes.
Like a literal buffet. Like it felt like a literal buffet.
I wrote them down. Should I go through them?
Yes.
So the first one we get is a naked Justin straddling naked Brian in the Le Corbusier chaise, feeding ice cream to him.
Oh, and the ice cream just dripping on their naked bodies.
Yeah, I think this was an extended version, though. I remember it from the other episode. Mm-hmm. This one went on longer.
We got more of the memory. I liked it. Yes.
The next one was showering together and then fucking in the water.
Yes.
Loved it. Mm-hmm. Justin getting topped hard in bed. Loved it.
Yes.
And then the metaphorical closing of the door on that part of his life.
You know, I almost expected to see all of those moments as he was shutting the door to like appear, because we got them in like bits and pieces, but I was expecting to see like almost a montage of it right in front of him. Mm-hmm. And I think that would have been very interesting. And to see him literally closing the door on that chapter in his life.
The same shot was used when Brian came in to the loft and started to realize that Justin has picked up all of his stuff. So Justin only had one drawer in Brian's loft, though. Drawers are for your regulars. They're not for like the live-in boyfriend. The live-in boyfriend has like closet space.
But how much does Justin really own?
He's not that poor.
But I mean, he left home and
yeah,
really, I just felt like he had like a pair of terrible cargo pants and
his Levi's
and his school uniform. That's sort of all he really had to work with.
A couple of Hollister shirts with the collar popped.
Sure.
So I thought it was significant that Justin left behind the computer and the rage drawings, though it felt a little contrived when Brian found them. It was like, oh, of course he found them. There they are. Look.
Yes. The creator is leaving behind his work for his muse kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
Very planted, I think is a great way to put it.
I've got some more notes about Michael.
Yes. Continue.
So back to that stale old story of Michael and his anti-Justin attitude. This seems tired. And I just thought it was a major biff for Conan Lippman to just keep bringing it back again. Michael is all, Brian, are you okay? It's like, of course he is. You fucking moron. How little do you know about him?
For someone who is his best friend, he clearly doesn't understand how Brian operates.
And this was, I thought, a little bit of a gap in the Brian-Michael character dynamic. So, okay, if there was this breakup, you'd be worried about your best friend. You'd be concerned, like, dude, you good?
Right. If you need to talk, I'm here. And leave it at that.
Yes. Yes.
Why is that difficult for Michael? No, Michael wants to literally insert himself so he can always be that shoulder to cry on. He has to make sure that it's promptly there.
And to do so, they had to give Brian a nudge off of his pedestal. Mm-hmm. He had to be much more vulnerable. And that's not something that we normally see in Brian. So it's like Conan Lippman dumbed down Brian in order to benefit Michael. I didn't like that.
No, because what it also does is it makes Michael, again, such a fucking prick in this episode. Like, I sat there watching this thinking, you know, there were times where I found Michael a little childlike, a little naive, but I'll go with it. Here, he was vindictive towards Justin in the worst possible way and sees no fault in anything that Brian did whatsoever. Nothing is ever Brian's fault.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, come on, man. You've got to be a little bit smarter. You've got to be able to read what was going on in this relationship a little bit. Come on. Because, like, let's talk about the diner scene.
From the first night that we met and he took me home and fucked me, you have wanted me gone. Well, Mikey, you finally got your wish. There's nothing standing in your way anymore. He's all yours.
You know, since you're no longer with Brian, there's really no reason for you to be here, is there? So why don't you just do us all a favor, including yourself, and disappear?
This was a recycled scene, though. This had happened before when early on in season one, where Justin is also taking out the trash.
And again, this is Michael 1.0 turned to 11. So Justin is coming to work. He works at the diner. Sorry, Michael.
Yeah.
And Justin is going out and taking the trash, and Michael decides, oh, it's time for me to let Justin know that he has to get packing.
Yeah.
So he goes out there, and they have their little tete-a-tete as Justin is like, isn't this what you always wanted, though? I'm out of his life. Done. And Michael says, good, now get the fuck out of all of ours. This is a great time for you to just get the hell out of all of our lives. So am I to assume, Michael, that you are telling Justin that because he is no longer dating your best friend, he has to quit his job, never go out to Liberty Avenue ever again, and basically get out of Pittsburgh?
He told him to disappear.
Who the fuck are you, man? To tell Justin to do anything. And I was so proud of Justin to stand up to Michael, because he's always done that. He's always managed to call Michael out on his bullshit and never really feel shaken by him. But because Michael here has been amped up so hard to that he's so happy he can finally treat Justin like apparently like the trash he thinks he is, that Justin is even shaken to like the degree that he's just been given. I did not understand this whatsoever.
Something I really liked about this scene is it was just gritty and aggressive handheld shooting. And it really added this edge to it as Justin's lugging the garbage out. Here comes Michael. He looks like kind of evil. It really added a nice texture to it that I liked.
It's very indie film.
Yeah. Debbie and Michael have a nice scene a little bit later where they're arguing. And I like that Debbie withheld lasagna.
And after all I did for that kid.
After what we all did, I told him loud and clear.
Told him what?
That he's a selfish, ungrateful little prick and he should get the fuck out of our lives.
You told him that?
I sure did.
Give me that.
What's the matter with you?
Whatever happened between those two boys is none of your goddamn business.
Brian happens to be my best friend.
Yeah, I know all about your best friend.
That is like ultimate punishment.
Yeah, that's the ultimate slight from Debbie when she withholds the Italian food from somebody. You know that you're in trouble.
Yes, because here they're having this conversation and Michael saying like, yeah, you know, I did it for everybody and I'm glad I did it. And this is exactly what I fucking told him. And Debbie's like, what the fuck is the matter with you?
Yeah, no lasagna for you.
Nope, I'm going to grab this casserole dish and you get the hell out. And I was like, thank you, Debbie. All I have in my notes on that moment was go, Debbie, go in all caps.
Yeah.
I was so happy. I was like, good, yes. Tell Michael you're being an asshole to Justin just because they broke up. Like,
well, we find out here that everybody is on Team Justin except for Michael.
Michael's the only one.
I thought it was a little crazy that Michael would think that everybody would just be like, yeah, get out of here, Justin. Go away. As if Michael had never seen breakups with his friends before, where friends like choose sides and stuff like that.
Do we know if Brian has ever been in a relationship like this? Where a guy has stuck around like this?
It doesn't necessarily have to be Brian, but surely he's seen breakups before where the friends get divvied up amongst each other.
I honestly don't know, because his reaction is just so extreme.
Yeah, it's so extreme and it's so biased towards Brian, which I guess we shouldn't be surprised by. And yet Justin doesn't seem to realize this and he just believes Michael. He quits his job, made the rounds to say goodbye. And that seemed atypical for Justin.
And I think because Michael was so aggressive towards Justin that even Justin was shook.
But I don't understand why Justin would suddenly become such a wuss. I mean, he took on his dad before. He took on Brian before. He took on Chris Hobbs in a bat.
Yeah, he took off Chris Hobbs too.
You're still talking about that?
Well, I was looking at GIFs earlier and I found one that is literally that jerk off scene. So that may show up in our social media later.
Yeah, Twitter only, not Facebook. No, guess who showed up in this episode?
Who?
Gus. And he's suddenly a gigantic child.
The animatronics, again, this is because of the Lord of the Rings movie. The animatronics are fantastic for Gus.
No, this is the first live Gus. We haven't seen a live Gus in a long time. We've had like fake Gus's, but Gus was there.
Right, at the...
In the park.
In the park, yes.
So Lindsay and Brian are going for a walk.
It's not too late.
For what?
To get him back. All you have to do is tell him you love him. It's not too much to ask. A small sacrifice.
I'm not so sure that Justin would actually come back. Right now, though.
No.
Even if Ryan had said that. So I'm not too sure if I buy what Lindsay is selling there.
I think Lindsay thinks it's that easy, that that was the only thing Justin was looking for. I think it was a good part of it. It also makes it very clear. It makes it clearer, I should say, where Brian stands in this whole relationship business and why he's so adverse to it. And I start to understand Brian's position more in specifically in this scene. Because what we're seeing is, in this park, we're seeing heterosexual couples with the baby cart and taking the walk in the park. Brian is trying to make a point that the whole...
Well, he comes right out and says, I never loved him.
Brian is trying to fight against the heteronormative narrative that he believes is now expected of him, now that, we see someone like Lindsay and Melanie have gotten married, they have a child, he's somehow supposed to maintain this relationship. But the whole point of being queer is that you aren't heteronormative, that you are specifically not trying to pass or assimilate into everyday society. Like that's the point. And that's why we see a lot of that even today. We see a lot of that pushback.
I think that's the point with Brian. I think for a lot of people, it just comes naturally that they couple and they have a child, mm-hmm. they get a stroller, they go to the park. I don't know that is heteronormative in so much as it's just people being what they want to be. Whereas in the early 2000s, it was often looked at as, how dare you try to be straight? How dare you try to be like them? And Brian has said a couple times, there's two kinds of straight people, the ones that hate you to your face and the ones that hate you behind your back. So I didn't so much have a problem with them in the park that way. What I did have a problem with was Brian actually saying, I never loved him, because everything that he did in season two was demonstrating his love. Are we to believe that he simply didn't realize he was in love? Or, I mean, Brian's a fairly high-functioning, what would the psychiatrist call him? A high-functioning bastard or whatever that was?
Yeah. Well, okay, so I...
He should know this.
I think whatever he was feeling for Justin, he wouldn't put on the label in love, because again, that's part of, as I was mentioning, the heteronormative culture. He clearly had the Brian feelings, the Brian equivalent of love for Justin, but he wouldn't call it that because to him that makes him seem like one of the straights.
But you can still love people though, right?
Yes, but he doesn't want to call it that, or he doesn't.
He called Justin a partner in season two.
Did that feel believable though?
Did
that
feel real? I thought it did when he came back from Brown Athletics. He's like, Sunshine, your partner just made partner. That was like a tender, loving moment that he wanted to share with Justin.
Then maybe what's going on is the characterization is getting muddled for me then.
Yeah.
Because I think what we're seeing in Brian right now is something that we definitely saw in the beginning of the series.
And this could be some of the awkward writing going mm-hmm. on here, where this is basically a recycled story where
yes.
Michael wants Justin gone. Justin goes away. Brian's like, why'd you do that? Justin comes back.
Right. I was like, didn't we do this 20 episodes ago?
Exactly. More like 42 episodes ago. And then that idea is furthered when Brian and Michael are at Babylon together. And that was a direct link to pre-Justin.
Right. And then I think it's more of there. I think that there's more of a direct point to show that, to show them it was literally like old times. It was just the two of them. And they even have that moment where literally everyone in Babylon just disappears.
Oh, I love
that. I thought that was like a really great little moment to bring to a literal light.
I've always wanted to see scenes of what Brian and Michael were like before episode one, where Justin comes into the picture. There's just a lot of it that we just have to assume.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think I might have liked to see 3 to 4 episodes of just Michael and Brian building up this best friendship that always comes into play. And then he shows up.
And then we see the...
the one night stand that never left. I don't know. Why was that scene there, though, in Babylon? Is it about Brian just going back to what he knows? Or is it about Michael desiring to live in that time again? Which is weak, considering that there's very little conflict going on with Ben moving in with him. Why would he want to go back to that?
Absolutely. Because as much as Michael wants to think it's the way things were, it's like, yeah, but you have this gorgeous hunk of man waiting for you at home. Which yeah, he even points out, saying like, I have to go home. Michael and Ben have that moment where they're about to get it on. And Brian just busts in saying, I need someone to go to Babylon with me now.
I've had friends like that.
And Ben's like, just go. Just go take him because clearly he needs to go.
I felt like the show did better with Dr. David Cameron and Michael fighting about Brian. Ben was just kind of like, fine, I guess. Ben Dr. David Cameron was just like declaring open warfare on it.
Dr. David Cameron was a bull. Oh. And I was into it. Right? Okay. Give us a moment, listeners. Whew.
That was more of an Ethan moment.
Whereas Ben is so much more zen and is probably more receptive of the relationship that Michael and...
Dr. David Cameron.
No, that Michael... I think Ben is more...
You forgot his name.
No, Ben is more receptive to the relationship between Michael and Brian.
Oh,
is what I meant to say. In that he knows when Brian has a need that needs to be fulfilled and Michael is clearly the person that... otherwise, Brian's never going
to
go away.
I like that Michael just can't say no to him. There's yes. Something, I don't know, that I just find very appealing about that.
He's just a boy who can't say no. He's in a terrible fix.
I'm just a girl who can't say no. I'm in a terrible fix. I always say, come on, let's go. Just when I ought to say nix.
Yeah.
So this episode circled back to the Dyke Party, picking up a little bit before the rewind moment. Michael, of course, is livid that Justin is there with Ethan, but I thought those two looked great together.
Beautiful couple.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So Randy Harrison and Fab Filippo played this scene very well. They were very much a couple. And you see Ethan taking his place, you know, behind Justin. This is essentially Justin's party. So Ethan is there in support of him. And he smiles in all the right moments. And
he does the introduction right with Mel and Lindsay. I'm just like, oh, listeners, I'm sorry, but we love this. We love Ethan.
Yeah.
Hate us all you want. Add us in the comments. But, you know.
I would like to see an expanded spinoff of this, like Justin and Ethan, the college years.
Yes.
The art school years. So Ethan passed the Debbie test, which was critical.
As for you, you're fucking adorable is what you are.
You're in, kid. You're in.
Then Brian shows up at the anniversary party, and Melanie and Lindsay are pissed off, but they invited him.
Well, he didn't show up alone.
Yeah, but the two Leathermen that he, or daddies, what are they?
Well, they were Leathermen.
Leathermen. Yeah, yeah. That show up. They were harmless. It's not like
they were wonderful. I loved that they showed up because
arguing about
silverware. And Mel and Lindsay, like, they find the common ground in terms of helping them figure out their dilemma.
The King Edward is stunning,
and the Queen Mary's a classic.
But we went with the Empress Alexandra.
It's elegant enough for dinner.
It's sturdy enough for every day.
Yeah. It's lovely. Don't you think so, honey?
Lovely. So how long have you two been together?
8 years and still counting.
Kane Ahura.
And I was like, I love this.
This just seemed like manufactured anger, though, just to solely pit the entire cast against Brian, except for Michael.
Right.
Like, everybody had to have this moment of turning against Brian and twirling their mustaches and saying, he got what's coming to him.
It's just like Michael's birthday party, where Brian went to the extreme to fuck up, and everyone gets their hand. It's the airplane moment again. It is the airplane moment again. Everyone is lining up to get their shot in.
Oh, that's awesome. We're going to have to put a GIF of that up just to make sure that everybody knows what we're talking about. I think we've mentioned this probably 5 times now.
But it's so accurate.
So, surprise, Justin is taking a piss right when Brian needs to. Good timing.
Yeah, so they go in and piss together. I think they cross streams.
This line here really stuck with me.
By the way, I hope you get what you want.
He's acknowledging that he can't slash won't give Justin what he wants while at the same time seemingly wanting the best for him. It was just such a loaded line, though, that it really resonated with me. And Justin looked entirely skeptical of it, though.
In what way did it resonate with you? Like, in that you understood Brian's plight, or that his love, that this is him showing his love for Justin?
It was Brian showing his vulnerability. Okay. And these moments when Brian is vulnerable are the ones that really, really resonate with me. It was nice to see Brian with his guard down, his fly down, and
his cock out.
Yep. But then saying, I really hope for the best for you. He was like acknowledging, like, I can't give this to you. I just want whatever's best for you. It wasn't a loaded line.
And that, I think, is the best way that in this moment, Brian can show his love for Justin by actually letting him go and getting what it is that he really needs.
And then comes the big scene. I thought it was great to see Brian as a voice of reason here trying to shut Michael the fuck up.
Do you believe the nerve of that little twat showing up here with his new boyfriend? I told him to stay the fuck out of our lives.
Why'd you do that?
After what he did?
He didn't do anything. We were never happily married. He was always free to go, so was I.
You're just saying that. He's a selfish little shit.
Be quiet, Michael.
He used you and he took from you and he never gave back a thing.
I said be quiet.
And this is the thanks you get for saving his life. If you ask me, it wasn't worth it. You might as well have just left him lying there.
But Michael is just going.
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it when he went nuclear and just actually wished death upon Justin.
When he says you should have just left him, oh damn right, you're gonna get punched out.
Good job, Brian.
What the fuck? Yeah, let's break this down, because Michael, are you trying to tell us that you are that angry at Justin that you would have preferred that he be laying dead right now?
It's not the first time he said that either.
But here it's like, I think you mean it.
So it felt a little fake though. It was just outlandish. It's like,
oh, again,
how can you like wish death on somebody
for breaking up with someone? Like, really? Everybody else at this party is not nearly as upset about you, including the people that did the breaking up.
So this was a great stage punch on Michael, though, complete with the jaw going. La, 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 la.
Yes, in the slow-mo.
I just thought that this was too over the top, though. And for me, it's where the episode fell apart. Everyone turns on Brian then.
Yes, don't even look. I love what Debbie says. She's like, don't even look at him. He hit my kid or some shit like that.
Even though it's Michael really had it coming. I mean, nobody deserves to get punched, but.
Oh, no, he fucking deserved to get punched.
Maybe slapped.
No, he deserved to get punched.
Fair enough. Then Ben has to be restrained. Ben's like about to tear him apart. Ooh, and
Ben went into beast mode. I was like, Endo, he's going to defend his man.
There's a great reaction shot of Justin wondering, wow, I've never seen Brian fight for me like this before.
I'm pretty sure Justin came in his pants.
So that, this episode was pretty messy. And for me, that's where it kind of booted all over the car floor.
Yes.
But this makeup scene between Michael and Brian, I thought was good.
You never hit me before. But I guess after what I said, I deserved it. You must really love him.
Look, I told him from day one, I don't believe in love. I believe in
fucking. Yeah, I know.
Except for you, of course.
I'm honored.
I want you to make up with him.
No fucking way.
But you have work to do. Rage. Volume 1, issue number 2.
Forget it.
Well, what about Mikey's big dream?
He'll just have to get himself a new one.
There was this nice, awkward tension with Brian being the bigger man. Mm-hmm. And he initiated the apology, which I don't think he actually apologized, though, didn't he?
No. No, I don't think.
We've only heard one apology before, and Karen Walton wrote that apology. And we had a major disagreement with Karen about that.
In his way, Brian does his mea culpa in terms of
with a bloody steak.
With a steak.
A Kansas City steak, mind you.
I mean, we give the best meat from Kansas City, man.
So what was Brian's motivation to encouraging Michael and Justin to keep working together, though? Why would it matter?
He knows how much it meant to Michael to create a character like Rage.
Yeah.
And he said, you can't let something like me and Justin be what stands in your way of your dream.
But he's doing this all... I just didn't get his motivation there. It didn't make any sense because Justin's out of his life. Michael's in his life. Is it because he wants Michael to see Michael fulfilled? Is it because he wants to see Justin earn money to pay for school?
I think it's less about Justin and more about Michael.
Or does it Brian like the vanity of having a comic drawn of him?
I would say it's 80-20 between making Michael fulfilled and the vanity.
Yeah.
I really don't think Justin is part of the equation from Brian's perspective. It's more about Michael realizing his dream.
Yeah.
I know. It's something that I know, I don't think the writing 100% gives us, but that's me trying to find where I think they were going with it.
Well, this story then gets entirely wacky and jumps the shark when Brian hires a Justin lookalike escort.
That was creepy.
Well, I like the idea of it.
I understand the point behind it.
I thought it was ridiculous.
It was creepy.
Yes, we get it. Brian misses Justin. The only thing that could have made this better, though, would have been if Brian just wrapped his arms around the hooker and cuddled him.
Instead he's going to rough fuck him.
Yeah. By the way, it was the fastest boner condom application and penetration we'd ever seen.
And based on the moan that hustler gave, I don't think lube was really involved. He told him, he said, like, turn over and then, like, just
bam.
And he went.
Yeah, I just wish that they would have not fucked. I think that scene would have been so powerful without that.
If it literally had been just that comfort.
Or like watching TV or something.
I think it's hell of a lot more interesting if it was just the comfort rather than I'm just going to.
Yeah, we got to work on the sex scene here.
Really?
There was great music here, though. This was another Sigur Rós song, and it's another glossolalia song where there aren't traditional lyrics, but there are vocalisms as the lead. Sigur Rós calls that style Hoplandic, or Icelandic, which is sort of a non-lexical Icelandic-sounding language. And this song had an Icelandic title as well, but the English title is simple, Sigur 4. Great song. Just a reminder for listeners, we're reviewing the original episodes from DVDs. If you're watching the show on Netflix, Showtime, or Viceland in Australia, you're getting a totally different soundtrack, which categorically sucks. So if you want to see this scene, pick up the DVDs. It's a really, really nice song. And the music supervision in the show is really good. So do yourself a favor and don't watch these on streaming TV.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
So I love that everyone wanted details about Emin and Ted hooking up. They're all wondering. Melanie and Lindsay take pictures of them together. They have a conversation about everyone thinking they hooked up when in fact they know that they didn't. But what's their motivation here?
It was very invasive, I thought.
Well, it's as if they wanted everyone to think they hooked up.
Why? It was almost as if everyone was just so excited that this was happening that it built into some sort of fairy tale for everybody.
Oh, I like
and
that.
But then it puts the pressure on Ted and Emmett about like disappointing them in some way.
Yeah, I didn't get this at all. Gay guys would fuck right away. Well, let's get it on. Got to get it
sure.
on.
Sure.
No choice but to get it on.
Well, we can
mandate get it on.
Well, see, we can do that when there are anonymous strangers. Like,
yeah,
we
like
can
the find, hooker that we came can, over.
Yeah, we can find it. We can find a trick anywhere on the street and be like, hey, let's just do this. But now let's throw in the fact that these are two people who have years of history.
Yeah.
Of friendship. And then how does that Because now you're crossing a threshold of the boundary of what that relationship was.
No problem. I've wanted you for decades. Take your pants off.
Did he though? Because remember last season I had, or remember a few episodes ago, I had a real problem. I think we both had a real problem in how all of a sudden Ted just kind of is in love with Emmett.
True. I guess that tracks with the story because Ted didn't so much have a problem with it, that Emmett was the shy one. Even though Emmett, it was a porn star that had whacked off a million times in front of Ted, and Ted seen him naked in the shower all the time.
That was business.
Yeah.
Now there's like an emotional emotional attachment to it.
It's like the Queer as Folk book. It said that they had intimacy problems. I don't understand intimacy problems. It's like, as Ted said in one of the first porn episodes, you take your putt out and you pull.
What do you mean? What do? You grab your putt and you pull.
Again, that was business.
This is business. Do some business.
It's a different kind of business.
There's something that occurred to me here is that to date, I don't think that we've ever been inside Emmett's bedroom.
Yeah, with all the people that we know have been inside Emmett, we've never been inside Emmett's bedroom.
We get a
when Emmett was trying to find a roommate, they were fucking everywhere but the bedroom.
But we get a quick glimpse into his bedroom in this episode when he comes out to kind of challenge Michael when he says, "I can't imagine hooking up with my best friend."
The fact that that sentence left Michael's mouth, and then we see Emmett turn around, mouth agape.
Really?
Really, Michael? Really? But he was set up for the volley to be like, really, Michael? We don't have to deal with all the times we hear about how you wanted to get your brains fucked out by Brian. But he doesn't land the spike. He makes it more about himself and Ted saying, like, what is it about us that doesn't make sense to you? I was like, no, this is where you call out Michael for all of his fucking sex fantasies he's had of Brian. And that everyone knows.
That look on Emmett's face, it kind of made me think of like you're chatting with some nice guy on like Grindr or Chappie or Tinder. And then bam, all of a sudden he just out of nowhere sends a whole picture. And you're just like, really? Wait a
minute. That was the vibe you were getting from this conversation? Oh, my personal favorite is when albums get unlocked and then they talk to you.
Oh, yeah.
Like I had one today. It was an unlocked private album. And then all I wrote back was, hello. And the response was, pics.
I like to troll people. If somebody says, looking, I'm like, huh? As if like, I don't know what they're saying.
Actually, from now on, what I want to do is if someone sends me looking, I'm going to send them a link to the looking IMDb page.
There you go. I've got a pretty hard and fast rule that if somebody just sends me unsolicited pics as their hello, that I block them. So
that's fair.
If somebody says hello, I'll generally talk to them. If all of a sudden there's like whole pictures and other pictures as like a way to say hello, I think of that as more like harassment. Like,
I think that's, I mean,
it's like being flashed in the park.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of trench coat.
It's unsolicited. And while there are some people who are into that, there are others who are like, I have no interest, nor did I ask for this. Who do you think you are?
Yeah. So anyway, Emmett's bedroom. We do get a quick look inside of it, and it's decorated all in purples.
Lavenders, mauves.
Yes. Yeah, it's beautiful. We see his bedrooms later, but so far, like 42 episodes in, we'd never been in Emmett's bedroom.
Right, because he gets fucked everywhere else.
Yeah. So, oh my gosh, the Ted and Emmett hookup attempt, that first one, the table of toys.
The accoutrement.
The lighting.
Smorgasbord. Let's call it that. It was like a smorgasbord of toys.
And what was that lighting for? He had like that spinning multicolored light on. Who does that?
That he got from like FAO Schwartz. Like, what the hell?
I feel like if they are so awkward about trying to hook up that the whole thing is going to be doomed anyway.
Yes, because now
Where's the red hot attraction? Where's the I can't keep my hands off of you?
Yes, that first hot kiss they had at Babylon was just kind of like,
that's it.
Oh, like, now what do we do?
Yeah, we got to
like,
first base.
Really?
I think the only useful thing here is that they finally realized that they weren't quite sure about risking the friendship. So to all those people in our polls that said, hell yeah, go for it. Well, they weren't quite sure about this. They were thinking, oh, gee, what about our friendship here?
Now, did that doubt seep in that moment or during like hearing the story of Vic and Carlos? I love that. Don't bring him up. Then they proceed to tell the entire story.
Yeah. It's like, don't not bring helping. Him up. Just kidding. Bring him up.
Not helping.
So round two of sex was a little bit different. They just built it up way too much to the point that everything was just unbelievable. And like I've said in other episodes, this much discussion rarely happens between two gay guys before they hook up. It's like the physicality of it overrides everything else. So I don't know. This storyline didn't resonate well with me. I felt it was drama for drama's sake.
Right. And there was so much more focus and clarity on our main storyline that everything else that was happening in the episode felt very much...
Yeah, just filling the blanks here.
Yeah, it's like, we got 38 minutes of the main storyline. We got 5 minutes left. Let's just throw this together and done.
I had a moment where I thought that Professor Ben Bruckner is a total moron. And
what part was that?
Well, okay, I'm going to go to Tibet. Let me let the house. Okay. I'm not going to go to Tibet. Oh my God, where am I going to live? I forgot I left the house. Oh, what?
Well, it wasn't that he forgot. It's just that he was saying, well, now that I'm not going, it makes sense that I don't. And so, again, and I feel like for convenience sake, we now know that he subletted his place to a lawyer.
Melanie. The interesting thing here, though, is another like retroactive continuity moment. This means that he actually decided to go to Tibet before he told Michael that he was thinking of going to Tibet. He sublet the house. He's going. So all this nonsense about him, like, do I go? Do I stay? Should I stay or should I go? Michael, I'm staying for you. Debbie, he let that house. He was going.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He was going.
So I know a good solution here. Move in with Michael. It's been eight months.
Let's move this storyline along by saying, oh, look at that. He doesn't have a place to live. Michael's got the extra space.
Which he really didn't have. It's a two-bedroom place. So with one bathroom.
For three people. Three men at that.
For some reason, Ben seemed entirely different in this episode. He seemed like less adult.
A little out to sea almost.
Because remember when he first came into the picture, he was doing all that professor shit and... He was like very wise and he wanted to dance until he dropped dead and live in the now. Mm. Now he's like, he can't live anywhere. He has no home. So this is like the de-evolution of Professor Ben Bruckner. Probably find out that he's a teacher's assistant.
No, he has a whole class. Let's not ruin the fantasy for me. Okay.
I enjoyed seeing Brian re-engaging Michael as his wingman, though. That seems to always happen in breakups. We get a little bit of minor conflict between Michael and Ben. But I really hope for more there. Ben was just too understanding. Like we were talking about, he just kind of smiled and nodded. And it's like, okay, I just wanted to see him lose his shit.
Well, he does at the party.
Yeah, that's true. He wanted to kill him. Mm. Okay, so let's recap this episode. We're going to do something different in season three, and we're going to call it Hits and Misses. So for each episode, Matt and I will pick one hit and one miss from the episode. So my hit is Justin waking up to the naked fiddler serenading him. As I talked about before, there's something very similar happened to me with the hipster playing a Smashing Pumpkins song and guitar. So I love this scene. So that was my big hit.
In my hit, I want to point out how super critical I found it that Debbie stand up for Justin against Michael. And that she also makes it very clear that Michael does not speak for everyone at the party. She makes sure to tell Justin that you don't have to go anywhere. We still love you and don't think that anything like that is going to change. So as much as Michael thinks he speaks for everyone in this moment, I appreciated that Debbie let Justin know and that it speaks to that. That's the comfort. That's why Debbie's around. She's that comforting mother figure for everybody. And I'm glad that she shows that Justin is in the circle, no matter what might have transpired between him and Brian.
Yeah, that's a good hit. I like that Debbie kind of marshaled everybody.
She laid down that law.
Like Howard Bellwether, she was the gay social conscience of Pittsburgh. So my miss was Emmett and Ted's build up to their first fuck. It just seemed so unrealistic to me. part of it could be Ted's just overall general awkwardness. But I feel like two horny gay guys would just have zero problems making it work without having such baggage, even if they've known each other for years and years and years. So I thought that storyline really missed.
My miss, and I mentioned it at the beginning of this episode, is that sports commentator
track.
The boxing
commentator.
Boxing commentator track that was used at the very beginning.
The only thing missing was like Brian showing up wearing brown athletic clothing.
We were like, okay, this is way too on those. I just found it really a very simple, easy choice and overall very cheesy. So it just did not work for me.
Okay. So this has been episode 1 of season 3, Mad Dog Kinney.
Next time, free of Brian, Justin must find a way to pay his tuition.
Melanie wants another baby.
And Emmett is tempted when an old flame drops by.
Oh, I love that story so much. Did you watch that episode yet?
I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, it's great. That will be episode 2 of season 3, and it's called House Full of Children. Thanks for joining us tonight. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us tonight, and subscribe. It really means a lot to us, and it helps more people find our show.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
You can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall with no E's.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
So until next week, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
See you next time. Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.